Alan Gring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 26, delivered on December 8, 2016. The title of this lecture is Review for the Final Exam.
Tonight, review for the final exam. It is seven questions, of which you answer five. And you will, the same rule applies. Rules apply. No more than two sentences. Proper spelling, punctuation, grammar, the whole nine yards. One good thing about answering five instead of four is that, did you notice on these tests, if you got one completely wrong, that really knocked your score hard? This is not as bad because, I mean, you're not going to lose as many points if you lose something on this one. However, you should not be in a situation on the final where you're going to completely go blank on anything. But okay, now, so a few details about this. I take exams one and two, and I copy and paste three questions from there, two from one of the exams, one from the other, and I paste those on the final. So you will have seen three questions before, okay? In other words, there's something there that you will know what I want because I showed it to you and then I told you what the right answer was supposed to be when we did the review after the exam. So that should help you out considerably, just that simple thing alone. These would be core objectives of the course. So think about what the syllabus says about the objectives of FIL 240. Things like risk and return would be, that's a core objective for heaven's sakes. Stocks and bonds, diversifiable and non-diversifiable risk. All of those are core objectives of the course. You'll notice the course objectives include capital budgeting, net present value, internal rate of return, that kind of stuff. Those are core objectives. The role of interest rates, that's a core objective. Capital structure, the last two lectures, that's a core objective too. So know that I am aiming at core. Things that you should know when you come out of this course. I mean, quite honestly, those of you who aren't even FIL majors, you forget lots of what comes in this. That's why in the next course I end up having to reteach half of 240 before I can move on. But there you go. That's how it works. Okay, down to a few, some business here. You can use your two note cards from the first two exams plus another note card for what we did after that last exam. Now, what we did after that last exam was capital structure. And that might give you a hint as to what I'm going to ask about it. Because I talked about capital structure and optimal capital structure. So it wouldn't hurt you to know what capital structure is and what optimal capital structure is. Hint, hint. Nudge, nudge. Wink, wink. Okay? Now, I already told you, it's probably going to be in your best interest to understand the relationship between risk and return. At this point, you should nail that son of a dog right to the wall. It's not risk that matters. It's a kind of risk. There are two kinds of risk. And only one of those risks matters. So if I ask you, what is the relationship between risk and return? You should know what kind of risk I want you to talk about and what kind of return I want you to talk about. Because you'll lose heavy points if you miss either of the qualifiers. What's the qualifier on risk? What is the qualifier on return that I get so bitchy about? Okay, I'm trying to telegraph my punch here. Doing my best to make you a champion. And again, another thing was risk itself. You should know about risk, that there are two kinds of risk in business, in investments. There's that systematic and that non-systematic risk. Know what each one is and what the return profile associated with it is. One of those doesn't have anything. Return is not something that has anything to do with it. The other one, there is a return, but it's not just the word return you should write. It's two words, something return, okay? This takes us to something else, too. A core objective of this course is for you to understand the difference between accounting and finance. And I try my best to make sure that you understand that we are not condemning, trashing, or otherwise diminishing the role of accounting. But it's not what we care about. Accounting numbers are actually, we have to use them if we don't have anything else. Oftentimes we have to reconstruct the real story from what you get in the accounting numbers. But in our business, there is profit that is not accounting profit. Largely that has to do with the cost profile. In accounting, costs are of one specific kind. They are, well, actually two specific kinds. They are direct and historical. Now, as far as finance is concerned, historical cost is the last thing we care about. History is dead to us. What happened yesterday is not what we care about. You can't live on the glory. There are companies all the time that live off their glory of their past years. And I mean, I have written condemning some of these companies. They get angry. You're living off your reputation. You're doing nothing new, nothing innovative now. Why should I recommend your company as an investment? And oh, there's anger at that. I can give you companies, HP, Nikon, companies like that, that wallow in their glory days and they're nothing now. For years, our automakers, the U.S. automakers, wallowed in their glory days of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and then they sat like crybabies when the Japanese came in and kicked their asses. Only in the last 10, 15 years have the American car companies come back and said, all right, now we have to look to the future and no longer to the past. So in finance, we care about expected future. We care a great deal about hidden costs that accountants can't talk about. Implicit costs. Now, don't use the word implicit. You've got to be explicit. You've got to tell me what you're talking about. What are some implicit costs or some costs that would not be in accounting statements that I have talked about? One was a big one they even talk about in economics. Do you remember? Opportunity costs. That's a huge one. There's another cost I talked about here, too. I know. That's why I'm doing this, is because that was the first part of the semester. And I mean, that's like out there. I want to bring it back in your focus. Replacement cost. You remember I talked about replacement cost? It's not what you paid for something. It's what you're going to have to pay for it if it breaks. It's that gasoline story. Gas retailer. He paid only $1.50 for his load of gasoline. But when the cost of gasoline skyrocketed, he should jack his price up like everyone else's who had to pay the higher price. Because on his next load, he's going to have to replace the gas that he's going to sell with that higher priced gas. So that's important, is no replacement cost. And to understand, honestly, this is one of the last things that I can tell you. It kind of comes into focus with in a course like this, is we use the word profit all the time. Every company talks about profit, profit. Honest to God, in the real hustle and flow of business life, profit is almost like something we talk about, but it really doesn't mean a lot. That's why in finance, we talk about free cash flow. What's there at the end of the day? I mean, I can show you on paper, I've got profit in my company. The question is, do I have the money to make it to the next year? Do I have money for something to eat that night? And that's not profit. That's cash flow. I mean, I can have a company that actually is not very profitable at all, but my free cash flow is really pretty, and I'm comfortable. There were nights I used to run I ran another business some years back, and it was that Thursday night when I had to make payroll, and that was what we call it, you make payroll. And it was just like, my God, please let me have enough money that I can write the 5 checks for my employees. And it's honestly like, hey, you get through that, and then you see if there's some money left. And quite literally, there were nights, oh, thank God, I've got enough money. I can actually eat at Denny's tonight. It was just that much. And you were grateful. That was free cash flow. You paid your bills, and then it was gravy time for you. And, okay. Now, another thing, what was that? It bites hard, too, because, I mean, there were nights when I had to go to my own savings and bring money out and make a transfer. Back then, you didn't have the electronic transfers and all that. So I'd write the checks, and then I'd rush to the bank in the morning to my personal account and get money out of that to put into the company's account just so I could pay the workers there. They were just so they were covered. And, I mean, that's when you realize that accounting, yeah, my bookkeeper did all that kind of stuff, but you have no idea what it's like, that free cash flow. And a lot of companies are coming back around to understanding that. Caterpillar, I told you the story. Caterpillar, one of their big wigs, was talking to my finance club students once, said, we were focused so much on profit for so many years that we nearly drove ourselves into the dirt. And now we're finally turning back to free cash flow. That was 3 years ago. Caterpillar is not even at the bottom of its struggle yet, trying to climb back out and refocus itself on the money that is available, not what the profit and loss statement says. Okay, another thing that I want you to make sure that you understand is what is meant by residual claim on assets, residual claim on cash flows versus prior claim on cash flows. You got to talk to me specifically about, and don't frame it in terms of bankruptcies. Talk about it in the normal day-to-day. That once the debt holder's claims have been satisfied in a timely manner, the residual belongs to the shareholders. And that money can be claimed by the shareholders. The shareholders can get that claim through two different mechanisms. You can satisfy the company can satisfy the shareholders' claim in two different ways. What are those two ways? There's money left over. It belongs to the shareholders. What can the corporation do?
Build dividends.
Or
reinvest and retain earnings.
Oh God, you almost did it, but then you did. Ah. Okay, can you tell me? I want you to go. And I want you to find any corporation. I'll give you any corporation. I want you to find the bank account that is called retained earnings. And I want you to find the person who signs at the bottom, his signature is retained earnings. Is it there? No, that's a myth. That's accounting. We are not accountants. We have risen above that. That's because you're wearing that damn baseball cap. Look at that C. What does that C stand for? Cubs?
Champs.
Yeah, I'll grant them. They deserve it. I mean, that was a long, what was it, 104 years? That's an awful long time. I mean, look, okay, no. You almost got it. You either pay dividends and or you reinvest the company, the money in the company with the prospect of capital gains. Okay, because, I mean, the shareholders love those dividends because it's money right away. But that's low risk, low expected return. Because if the company puts the money back into operations, there's a risk involved in that. It might not do anything. I mean, you might pour money into the company that belongs to shareholders and nothing happens. And also the shareholders are going to, I told you that story about that. I mean, I was, that this woman was just angry because we had not given a dividend. And she didn't see the stock price going up because, I mean, it's a long haul. You can't put the money in the back into the company and expect the stock price to jump the next day. It's going to be a long haul. Oh, she was just, I mean, she was like Cthulhu. I mean, Medusa. Snakes were coming out of her hair and yelling at me and everything. There's nothing you can do. I mean, look, I can give you a dividend. You got it. You go and do something with it. Enjoy it. Or I can put the money back into the company and grow, hope that that reinvestment pays off in a higher stock price down the line. But you got to show me that you understand the difference between the prior claim and the residual claim. Hit it on the head. Give you a warning. Some people lose points all the time when they write, well, the company can, after the company has paid its debts, then the residual belongs to the stockholders and bondholders. That would lose you most of the points right there. Let me repeat that and tell me why that's, why that would be a wrong answer, why that would show a completely fundamental misunderstanding. Well, after the debt holders have been paid, the residual belongs to the stockholders and bondholders. What's wrong with that? Madam? Exactly. Well, that's exactly right. But the person is showing that they don't understand that the bondholders are the most important of the debt holders. They have nothing to do with the equity. They are the other side of it. They are the debt. And they have the prior claim. So after they have, okay, you pay your light bills, you pay your shipping, you pay your salaries and wages, you pay your light bills, rent and all that, and then you pay also your interest expense on your bank loans and on your bonds, and then what's left belongs to the stockholders. You don't have to give me a distinction between preferred and common. Don't worry about that. Just make sure that you show me you understand the difference between debt, which has a prior claim, and equity, which has a residual claim. Don't talk about in bankruptcy and liquidation. Just talk about it in the normal hustle and flow of a going concern, a living company. Oh, mother's work is never done. We'll go through. Yeah, I think I'll just put the final exam up here on the board for you to look at. A few things that I would want you to know about. I spent time in the course on bonds, and so I'm going to certainly expect you to be able to answer a heavy question, something along the line of one that would be worth you, a couple that might be worth you knowing about. What happens to the price of a bond as the spread between coupon and yield increases? What happens to the price of a bond as the spread between coupon and yield increases? One more time. What happens to the spread on what happens to the price of a bond as the spread between coupon and yield increases? Now I'll tell you what would, you know you're giving me the wrong answer if you say, well, the price goes up, or you would say the price goes down. That would, you would know right there you had given me a wrong answer. Please don't make me work that hard grading 400 finals. Okay? Hit it on the head. Okay, you got the coupon on a bond. That's what the company is paying its lenders. The yield on the bond is what the market thinks the company should pay on the bond. Okay. Now, if the coupon and the yield are the same, if they are the same, you know what the price of the bond is. You know exactly the price of the bond as a number if the coupon and the yield are the same. What is the price of the bond if the coupon and the yield are the same? Do you know? Are you a golfer? Who's a golfer here, for God's sake? Yes. You're on a par 3 hole. You get one out there, goes down the fairway really nice. You go for the second shot, get it onto the green, and then you hit that third shot and it goes in the cup. You have par. Par is how many dollars? $1,000. So when yield and coupon are identical, the bond sells at par. But if the yield and the coupon are not identical, the price of the bond diverges from that. You don't know which way unless I tell you which way the spread is moving. If the yield goes above the coupon, the bond's price falls below par. If the yield goes above, I'm sorry, if the coupon goes above the yield, or rather I should say the yield goes below the coupon, then the bond will sell at a premium to par. But I'm not going to ask you that. I'm going to ask you the simple question. When the coupon and the yield spread increases, what happens to the price? Okay? So all you have to do is tell me what the price does relative to what it is when the bond, the coupon and the yield are the same. That's all you have to do. It is... You can answer it in 8 words, an 8-word sentence. You have to use a little bit of fancy, big words for it, but you don't have, it's not a complicated question. Okay, now the other part, other side. I could ask a question. As the term of a bond approaches zero, what happens to the price? As the term of a bond approaches zero, what happens to the price? Okay, now, I do want to make sure that before I forget, I'm going to try to find some gimmies, one or two gimmies, things that are nothing but definitions, something along the line of, what are the three types of money? Don't say M1, M2, and M3. That's not what I'm talking about. In fact, actually, I even mentioned a fourth type that's out there now, too. But we're not supposed to be mentioning that yet. We don't. Say that again? If you get the other ones right, you have to know the other ones, too. Interestingly enough, this is the first... Historically... As far as barter money goes, we know barter money has been around. I jumped into a conversation. One of my minors was anthropology. And I jumped into a conversation, and I was just attacked from all sides because everyone else there was cultural or physical anthropology. But there was this island off the coast of Greece, and they have evidence of the production of large numbers of small flint weapons, weapon heads, back before there were Homo sapiens. And they said, and this big mystery, why were Neanderthals making all these weapons? And I jumped into the conversation in a comment. I said, they were making these to trade. Bull crap they were using these themselves. They had found all these resources on the island. They were building these masses of weapons so that they could get them to the mainland and then sell them. It was a barter economy that was going on. And of course, everyone, that can't be. You're just an economist, you asshole. So I'm like, no, I smell. I mean, you don't make more than thousands of times more than you would need for just... because you like to do that. They were trading those. So barter economy probably goes way, way back. Metal money, I mean, metals as a commodity money have been around for a long, long time. We can probably go clear back to the Chalcolithic, 5,000, 8,000 years ago. As far as coin money goes, that had fiat value, that's probably during the Babylonians. Time, about 3000 BC. They had something they called shekels or shigols. And so fiat money is actually pretty old, but the new one in your lifetimes, the first new money in maybe 6,000 years in your lifetimes, the cryptocurrencies. That's very cool. You're living through something that hasn't happened in many, many, many centuries. Okay, but all you have to do is say the barter commodity and metal or commodity and fiat money. Okay, another one that would be I would toss at you maybe, what is liquidity? What do I mean by liquidity? I mean, these are like gimmies. Yeah, go ahead. Okay, that's acceptable. Usually you say liquidity, how quickly an asset can be turned into another asset, which is usually cash. But as long as you say cash, that's good enough for me. Yeah. Well, you know, like I said, the last one is the new one. You know, that very brand new one, like bitcoins and all of those. Those are the cryptocurrencies. Yeah. I mean, you can put that in there, but I'm not taking responsibility because I didn't teach you a damn thing about cryptocurrencies. I'm not supposed to talk about them yet. I mean, they don't exist. Nope, not at all. And I heard there was a lone gunman, too. But anyway, that's just me. Okay, now also another one. What is flight to quality? What's flight to quality? What is flight to quality? Those are just some gimmies that I want to make sure you can do. And finally, now the last thing I want to talk to you about, I gave you a couple of questions that I will, something like this is going to be on the final. It's a heavier one. Well, something along the line of a talking head is showing a stock price chart, and the stock price chart shows a lot of price volatility. Okay? And he says this is clearly and obviously a risky stock. Why could he be completely wrong? And just to emphasize this a little bit for you, while this is warming up, I'll go on here. But bear with me one quick second here while I put this up. Volatility really doesn't mean anything to us at all in finance. Unless you're some coke-snorting, old-time 1980s trader. Let me show you. Really? I'm trying to do Yahoo Finance. Finance. Yahoo.com. Let's try it again. JCP. Why do I keep doing this? And I'm trying to search. Really? Oh, well. I'll just do it this way. I don't get it why it's not showing me the screens that I want to show, but there you go. This is the stock price chart of JCPenney. Now, interestingly enough, when you see the stock price chart, notice how wildly volatile that price is. This is clearly and obviously a risky stock. Actually, the beta of this stock is only 0.85. This is a pussycat stock. It is a wild stock when it is on its own. But in a well-diversified portfolio, this stock is tame. When you are on your own, you're an axe murderer, sir. But at work, at a party, you're a very nice guy. I mean, you know, so really, I don't care about your axe murdering ways, you maniac. All I care about is what you do in a well-diversified portfolio, because no one is going to reward me for taking risks that I don't have to take. My expected return on JCPenney is not based upon this wild volatility. It's based upon that pussycat smooth up and down that this stock does in a well-diversified portfolio. The same is true of quite a few stocks, interestingly enough. I can show you stock price charts that are crazy wild, but when you take a look at their betas, these stocks are actually grandma and grandpa stocks. They're good for very defensive portfolios. Okay? So that's the context I want you to answer if I ask you a question like that. Now, the other question that I could ask you, another one that I could ask you, the Financial News Network is featuring the fund manager with the highest return on his fund portfolio for last year, praising this person as an investing genius. Why should you not be impressed? And there are actually two reasons for that. First reason is, how much risk was involved in what he did? Look, I've got a nice little Mazda 3. I pull up to a two lanes at a stoplight. The car beside me is a Maserati. Okay? He looks at me, vroom, vroom. I look at him, vroom, vroom. The light turns green. And there I am, 10 feet down the road. He's already in Chicago, okay? And he stepped out of his car, king of the road, alpha male, me, big man. He comes up to you, and he says, Molly, me Tarzan, you lucky, okay? Do you understand? Of course he won. He was driving a Maserati. Of course a fund manager is going to have a high return if he takes an insanely high risk. There's no hero in there. Good for you. You drove fast and you got there before I did. But you also could have killed yourself doing that. The other question that you have to ask, okay, did he take inappropriate risk? Was he on the security market line? In other words, was there diversifiable risk in his portfolio that he just let sit there? He wasn't rewarded for that. He could have been exposing his clients to insane risks they did not have to bear for the same return. So in other words, there are two dimensions always. There is the return, but there's also the risk. And the only risk that matters is the non-diversifiable risk. Even if his portfolio was perfect, non-systematic risk was removed from it, I'm still not impressed. Your portfolio had a beta of 2.9. Congratulations, you got a very high expected return off that. My beta on my portfolio was 1.2. I got the return expected for that risk level. There's no hero in driving a fast car fast. That's what it's meant to do. There's no hero in driving a portfolio to a high return if you took a high risk. There's nothing impressive about that. You might have a tolerance for risk, but this gets down to another thing that's really important for you folks. whether or not you manage your own portfolio, we have these two terms. One is appropriateness, and the other is consistency. Now, the appropriateness means, are you taking risks that are appropriate for the clients you've got? That's huge. I mean, you want to look like a hero to your clients, yeah. But if you're taking risks that they don't understand, they're not financially literate. They rely on you as a fiduciary agent. So you got to do things that are right for them based upon the appropriateness of the investments for them. The other thing is consistency. Just jumping in and attacking things that look like a great deal and jumping from one fun thing to another in your investing. That's inconsistency, and sooner or later, that'll catch up with you. Transactions costs build up through that, but also your pattern of behavior becomes an issue. When all you can do is one trick pony after another, sooner or later, the ponies are going to run out. And you have never built up a solid base of a model of investing that is good for your clients. And that's true in your own lives. You can jump from one quick investment to another early in your life, but sooner or later, you've got to set up, okay, I've got to get my major act together and create a portfolio that's a buy and hold. I do this and this, but I don't just dive into things just because someone recommends it for a day or two. Okay, so that's the second part. But anyway, going back to the question that I'm focusing on here, if I ask you a question about praise for investment managers, portfolio managers who get high returns, I want you to hit two issues. Were those returns commensurate with the risk, or was it all non-diversifiable risk? Was it all systematic risk, or was there risk that could have been shaken out? And the other part of it is, well, yeah, if he had all the non-systematic risks shaken out, if his portfolio was very clean as far as just having non-diversifiable risk, that beta he took on, that's fine. That's exactly what it should. He did what we would expect to happen. But was that appropriate for his clients? And that's the thing that you have to watch out for. Now it's your turn. I want you to ask me any questions. Yes? Don't. Because I'll tell you something. That weak law of large numbers is way overused. It is way overused. I promise you, not everything becomes a normal distribution. Not everything. As a matter of fact, most things don't.
Is that one kind of issue that if your chances are next year, you have
more losses? More likely, what we find with those kinds of winners like that, who win like that, they'll have a run of years. But then, when they fail, they never come back. I mean, I knew a couple of guys back in the 90s. They were top of the game. I mean, one of them had runs for 3 years in managing a portfolio of over 40%. He was a hero. But then, he never did that again after that 3-year run. And eventually, he was out on the street. He was a burnout. You know, basically, he was lucky he could get a job working at UPS, which was where he was working, after he lost some very powerful people, some very big money, several times. So, yeah, there's that problem there. But it's all unpredictable. What other questions? You got questions for me? I've tried to be as thorough as I can. Study those first two tests. Take my criticism seriously. Stay frosty on this, okay? Now, what I have for you tonight, I'm going to appoint three people to oversee doing the student evaluations. And as I told you, I've got office hours for you to handle this. Handle any questions that you have once we're finished with the... What was I going to say? Once you're finished doing your own studying, don't come into my office and say, what's going to be on the final, man, or anything like that. But let me write down some information for you. On these evaluations, you're going to write 548. The code is 240-548-240-00-0413. Okay, and I'm Alan Crane, in case you don't know who I am. One last piece of advice to you, and I've told you this, as they said in my combat battalion, keep your heads down and your fangs out. Seriously. It's a rough world out there. And it's better you than me that faces it. But that's all I have for you tonight. Elvis has left the building.